cover name for Tulip. Limas, what about her? Mayflower, last night Frau Sommer reported herself to my casualty unit suffering from delusions. We sedated her, but she discharged herself during the night. Limas, delusions of what? Mayflower, she fantasizes that her husband suspects her of betraying state secrets to fascist anti-party elements. Limas, thanks, noted. Unfortunately, I'm required in theater. Mayflower, understood. 2 hours intervened, during which Mayflower uncashed his theatre equipment, turned it to the recommended specifications, and finally obtained a weak signal. Sound quality patchy throughout the ensuing conversation. Footnote. Theatre is a prototype American short-range high-frequency communication system purpose-built for covert east-west communications within Berlin city area. Limas has described the system in a DO letter to H technical department as unwieldy, bloody fiddly, overproduced, and typical yank. It has since been abandoned. Substance. Early that same morning, Tulip had made an unprecedented crisis call to Mayflower in his surgery, consisting of an agreed series of pinpoint taps on the mouthpiece of a third-party telephone, in this case a call box. In return, Mayflower had signaled his assent. Two taps, pause, three taps. The emergency rendezvous, RV, was a spinny outside Köpenick, fortuitously the same spinny that he had previously chosen to cache his theatre equipment. Both parties arrived by bicycle within minutes of each other. Tulip's initial mood, according to Mayflower, was triumphalist. Quince was neutralized. He was as good as dead. Mayflower should rejoice with her. God had been at her side. Then the following narrative. Returning home from work late last night, Quince had grabbed the Zenit camera hanging from its strap behind the front door, opened its back, muttered something, snapped it shut and returned it to its hook. He had then demanded to inspect the contents of Tulip's handbag. When she resisted, he threw her across the room and searched it anyway. When Gustav ran to his mother's defense, Quince hit him across the face, causing bleeding from the mouth and nose. Evidently not finding what he was looking for, Quince then ransacked kitchen cupboards and drawers, frenetically patted the soft furniture, and stormed through Tulip's clothes and finally Gustav's toy cupboard, all without success. In Gustav's hearing, he then in a loud tone challenged Tulip to explain, in questions counted on his spread fingers, number one, why the family Zenit camera contained no film, number two, why there was only one unused film in the pocket of the camera case, although a week ago there had been two, and number three, why a film that only last Sunday had been sitting in the Zenit with two frames exposed was also missing. And by way of subsidiary questions, what had she photographed with the remaining eight frames? Where had she taken the film to be developed? Where were the results? And what had happened to the missing unused film? Or had she, his personal conviction, been photographing the classified documents he brought home and selling them to Western spies? The true facts of the situation, as Tulip well knew, were as follows. Since caching a Minox under the shower stand in the women's toilet of her corridor in House 3, Tulip had on principle kept no Minox either in the fastening of her shoulder bag or at home. If Quince brought documents of interest home from the GDR Foreign Office, Tulip would wait till he was asleep or engrossed with his male friends and photograph the documents with the family Zenit. On the previous Sunday, she had taken two snaps of Gustav on a swing in the playground. The same evening, while Quince sat drinking with friends, she had used the remaining frames of the same film to photograph documents from his briefcase. She had then removed the film from the Zenit, buried it in a flower pot pending her next treff with Mayflower, but had neglected to put a fresh film into the camera, let alone put her finger over the lens and shoot off a couple of frames to represent two misfires of Gustav. Despite all this, Tulip contrived to mount what she considered to be a devastating counterattack against her husband. She informed Quince, in case he didn't know, that there were many in the Stasi who remained suspicious of him on account of his odious father and reputed homosexuality, that nobody in the Stasi was taken in by his exaggerated professions of party loyalty, and yes, she had indeed photographed whatever she could get her hands on from his briefcase, not in order to sell to the West or anyone else, but to blackmail him in the event of a custody battle over Gustav, which she considered imminent. Because one thing was for sure, she told him, if it were ever to come out that Lothar Quince took home classified documents to obsess over during off-duty hours, his dreams of becoming a GDR ambassador abroad would be over. Return to tape. Limas to Mayflower. So how do things stand? Mayflower to Limas. She is convinced she has reduced him to silence. He went to work as normal this morning. He was calm, even affectionate. Limas, where is she now? Mayflower, at home, waiting for Emmanuel Rapp. At midday precisely, he will pick her up in his car and they will drive to Dresden for a full session of the domestic security Soviet. He has promised her that this time she will attend the meeting as his assistant. It will be an honor for her. 15-second pause. Limas. All right, so here's what she does. She phones Rapp's office now. She's been sick as a dog all night. She's got a barking temperature and she's too ill to travel. She's heartbroken. Then she aborts. She knows the procedure. She gets to the rendezvous. She waits. Limas then informed head office by crash telegram that the requirements for an emergency exfiltration of subsource Tulip had advanced from amber to red, and that since she was fully conscious to source Mayflower, the entire Mayflower network must be considered at risk. Since the escape plan required the collaboration of both Prague and Paris stations, the resources of joint steering were essential. He also requested immediate permission to undertake the exfiltration in person, in the full knowledge that, understanding circus orders, a serving officer possessing information of high sensitivity who proposes to enter denied territory without diplomatic protection must obtain the advance consent of head office in writing, in this case, joint steering. 10 minutes later, he had his answer. Your request refused. Confirm. J.S. The telegram was otherwise unsigned in accordance with H.J.S. Hayden's policy of collective decision-making. Simultaneously, Signals Intelligence reported a surge on all Stasi wavelengths, while the British military mission in Potsdam noted a tightening of security at all crossing points into West Berlin, all along the GDR, West German border. At 15:05 GMT, GDR Radio announced a nationwide search for an unnamed female lackey of fascist imperialism answering the following description. The description was of Tulip. Limas had in the meantime taken steps of his own. In defiance of joint steering's instruction, he makes no apology for this, claiming only that he wasn't going to sit on his arse and watch Tulip and the entire Mayflower network going up in smoke. When joint steering urged that at least Mayflower himself should be immediately exfiltrated, Limas's retort was uncompromising. He can come out any time he wants, but he won't. He'd rather stand trial like his father. Less clear is the part played by the station's recently upgraded assistant officer, Stavros de Jong, and Ben Porter, the station's security guard and driver. Testimony of Ben Porter, security guard, Berlin station, to PG, verbatim. Alex, at his desk on the secure blower to joint steering. I'm standing at the door. He puts down the phone and he turns to me and he says, Ben, he says we're on. It's a rolling job. Get the Land Rover out and tell Stas I want him in full drag in the courtyard in 5 minutes, he says. At no time did Mr. Limas say to me, Ben, I have to inform you we are doing this in direct contravention of head office instructions. Testimony of Stavros de Jong, probationer attached to H Covert Berlin, to PG, verbatim. I asked head of covert, Alec, are we sure head office is behind us on this one? To which he replied, Stas, take my word for it. So I did. Their protestations of innocence were mine, not theirs. Since I had no doubt that Smiley had encouraged Limas to undertake the exfiltration of Tulip himself, I was careful to supply Porter and de Jong with get-out-of-jail statements in case they were forced to give an account of themselves by Percy Allerline or one of his henchmen. It is 3 days later. The story is taken up by Alec himself. It is 10 o'clock at night and he is being debriefed across a plywood table in the safe room at the British Embassy in Prague where he holed out an hour earlier. He is talking into a tape recorder and on the other side of it sits the head of Prague station, one Jerry Ormond, husband to the redoubtable Sally, who is also the station's number two in a his-and-her circus partnership. Also on the table, if only in my informed imagination, a bottle of the Scotch whiskey and one glass only, Alex, which Jerry intermittently replenishes. By the lifeless tone of Alec's voice, it is clear that he is exhausted, which as far as Ormond is concerned is all to the good, since his task as debriefer is to take down his subject's story before his memory has had a chance to edit it. In my imagination again, Alec is unshaven and wearing a borrowed dressing gown after the hasty shower he has been allowed to take. The Irish comes through his voice in irregular bursts. And I, Peter Gwillem, where am I? Not in Prague with Alec, though I might just as well have been. I am sitting in an upstairs room of Covert's headquarters in Marylebone, listening to the tape that has been rushed to London by RAF plane, and I am thinking to myself, it's my turn next. AL. It's 8 below on the steps of the Olympic Stadium. Ball breaking, easterly blowing fine snow, ice on the roads. I reckon the foul weather's all to the good. Foul weather's escape weather. Land Rover's standing by. Ben's at the wheel. Stas de Jong comes marching down the steps in full army battle dress, squeezes himself into the floor cavity. All 6'3" of him. Army boots and all. Me and Ben lower the lid on him. I sit up front with Ben. I'm wearing an officer's cap and greatcoat, 3 pips, East German working clothes underneath. Scruffy shoulder bag under the seat for documents. Rule of mine. Keep your documents separate for the jump. 9:20 a.m. We're going through the official Friedrichstrasse crossing point for military personnel, showing our passes to the Vopos through the closed windows. Not letting the buggers get their hands on them, which the diplomats tell us is the current way of doing it. Soon as we're through, we pick up the usual tale. 2 Vopas and a Citroen. So it's a normal day. They need to know we're just another British military vehicle asserting our rights under the quadripartite agreement, and that's what we're keen to tell them. We pass through Friedrichshain, and I'm hoping to Christ the Tulip has hit the road by now, because if she hasn't, she's dead or worse, and so's the network. We head north towards Pankow till we reach the Soviet military perimeter and then turn east. Same Citroen on our tail, which is fine by us. We don't need changing of the guard and fresh eyes on us. I'm leading them a bit of a dance, which is what they expect us to do. The odd sudden turning, backtrack, slow to a crawl, put your foot down. We're turning south into Marzahn. We're still inside Berlin city limits, but it's forest, flat roads and flying snow. We pass the old Nazi radio station, which has our first marker. The Citroen's 100 yards behind us, not enjoying the icy roads. We go into the dip, gathering speed. There's a sharp left coming up and a white factory chimney poking out of the trees, which is our second marker. An old sawmill. We make the left turn fast, hold it, skid to a near halt next to the sawmill. I roll out, plus shoulder bag, minus greatcoat, which is Stas's cue to get out of his box and into the passenger seat and look like me. I'm flat in a ditch with snow all over me, so I must have rolled a yard or two. When I take a look, the Land Rover's climbing up the other side of the dip and the Citroen scrambling after it, trying to catch up. A pause, punctuated by the clink of glass and sounds of pouring liquid. AL continued. Back of the old sawmill, there's a disused lorry park and a tin shed full of sawdust. And behind the sawdust, there's a brown and blue Trabant with a load of steel tubing strapped to the roof. 90,000 on the clock and stinks of rat shit, but the tank's full and there's a couple of spare cans in the back and the tires have even got a bit of tread to them. Maintained by a trusted patient of Mayflowers who won't even give his name. Only problem is, Trabbies hate the cold. It takes me an hour to thaw her out and all the time I'm thinking, Tulip, where are you? Have they got you? Are you talking? Because if you're talking, we're all fucked. J.O. Jerry Ormond. And your identity? A.L. Gunther Schmaus, welder from Saxony. I give good Saxon. My mother was Chemnitz. My dad was County Cork. J.O. And Tulip? When you meet up with her, who will she be? A.L. My own dear wife, Augustina. J.O. And she's where at this minute, all being well? A.L. R.V. north of Dresden. Deep countryside. She'll have tried to bike despite the weather, gone a distance, then ditched her bike because they know she bikes. then taken the local train, then hiked or bummed a ride to the RV with orders to hunker down for as long as it takes. J.O. And the crossing from East Berlin to the GDR? What are you expecting? A.L. It's random. No checkpoints, roving patrols. You're lucky or you're not. J.O. And were you lucky? A.L. Wasn't a big deal. Two police cars. They cut you up, frighten the shit out of you, have you out of the car, shake you down. But if your papers hold on, you go. J.O. And they held, yes? A.L. I wouldn't fucking be here if they hadn't, would I? Change of tape. Corrupted passage, 45 seconds. Rejoin. Limas is describing the drive between East Berlin and Cottbus. A.L. Best thing about traffic in the GDR. Basically, there isn't any. A few horses and carts. Cyclists, mopeds, sidecars, the odd clapped-out lorry. A bit of autobahn, then small roads. I'm alternating. If a small road is snowed up, cut back to the autobahn. Steer clear of Wunsdorf, whatever you do. There's a bloody great Nazi camp there, and the Sovs took it over wholesale. Three tank divisions, serious rocketry, and a king-sized listening station. We've been spying the shit out of it for months. I make a detour north for safety's sake. Not an autobahn, just a straight, flat country road. There's heavy snow coming at me in lines of bare trees, chock-a-block with bunches of mistletoe, and me thinking, one day I'll come back and cut down that lot and flog it at Covent Garden Market. Then, am I dreaming this? I'm in the middle of a fucking great Soviet military convoy and I'm going the wrong way. Lorries packed with troops, T-34 tanks on low loaders, six or eight artillery pieces, and me in my piebald trabby dodging between them, trying to get off the fucking road and them just not bloody looking, rolling straight on. I didn't even have time to take their fucking numbers. Laughter shared by Ormond. Pause. Resumes at a slower pace. A.L. 4 in the afternoon. I'm 5 kilometers west of Cottbus. I'm looking for an abandoned carrier osteria works at the roadside. That's the RV. And a baby's mitten jammed on a bit of fencing, which is the safety signal to tell me Tulip's inside. And it was there. The mitten was. Pink. Stuck up there like a fucking flag in the middle of nowhere. And it scares me, don't know why. The mitten does. It's too fucking conspicuous. Maybe it's not Tulip inside the shed, it's the Stasi. Or maybe it's Tulip and the Stasi. So I pull up and think about it. And while I'm thinking, the barn door opens and there she is. Standing in the doorway with a grinning 6-year-old kid on her hand. 20-second pause. A.L. I'd never even met the bloody woman, Christ's sake. Tulip worked to Mayflower. That was a deal. Knew her from photographs, that's all. So I say, how do you do, Doris? My name's Gunther and I'm your husband for this journey and who the fuck is this? Except that I know too bloody well who this is. And she says, it's Gustav, my son, and he's coming with me. And I say, like, fuck, he's coming with you. We're a childless couple, and there's not going to be any hiding him under a bloody blanket when we reach the Czech frontier. So what are we going to do about it? She said that in that case she's not coming, and the boy chirps up and says he's not either. So I tell Gustav to get back inside the shed and grab her by the arm and take her round the back and tell her what she knows but doesn't want to hear. There's no ID for him. They'll pull us in and run a check on us, and if we don't get rid of him, you're fucked, and so am I, and so is the good Dr. Remek. Because once they've got you and Gustav in their hands, they'll squeeze his name out of you in 5 minutes. No answer, and it's growing dark, and the snow's coming on again. So we go back inside the shed, which is big as a bloody aircraft hangar and full of busted machinery, and Gustav, the little bugger, is laid for dinner, if you can believe it. Dug out whatever she's got from provisions and set them out on the ground. Sausage bread, a thermos of hot cocoa, boxes to sit on. Let's all have a party. So we sit in a ring and have our family picnic, and Gustav sings us a patriotic song, and the two of them bed down together under coats and whatever they've got, and I sit smoking in a corner. And as soon as it's half light, I shove them in the trabby and we drive back to the village I passed through the night before because I'd seen a bus stop there. And by the grace of God, there are these two old Nellies standing there in black hoods and white skirts and baskets of cucumbers on their backs, and God bless them, they're sorbs. J.O. Sorbs? What the hell? A.L. Outburst. Sorbs, for Christ's sake, you've heard of fucking sorbs. 60,000 of them, protected species, even in the GDR. Slavic minority, scattered up and down the Spray. Been there for centuries. Growing bloody cucumbers. Try recruiting one, Jesus. 10-second pause, cools down. A.L. I pull up, tell Tulip and Gustav to stay in the car. Don't move. I get out. The first old Nelly watches me, the other one doesn't bother. I pull the charm. Does she speak German? That's respect. She speaks German, but she'd rather speak Swabian, she says. Joke. I ask where she's heading. Bus into Lübenau, then train to the Ostbahnhof in Berlin to flog the cucumbers. They get a better price in Berlin. I picture a cock and bull story about Gustav. Family upset, mother distraught, boy's got to get back to his father in Berlin, and can they take him? She puts the proposition to her pal, and they have a debate about it in Sorbian. And I'm thinking any minute the fucking bus is going to come over the hill and they won't have made up their minds. Then the first one says, we'll take your boy if we buy our cucumbers. And I say, what, all of them? And she says, yes, all of them. And I say, if I buy all your cucumbers, you won't have any fucking cucumbers to sell in Berlin, so why would you want to go there? They have a good laugh about this in Sorbian. I shove a wad of cash into her hand, so much for the cucumbers, but keep them. And so much for the boy's train fare, and here's some more for his onward journey onto Hohenschönhausen. And here's the bus coming, and I'll get the boy. I go back to the car and tell Gustav to get out, but his mother just sits frozen in the car with her hand across her eyes, so he won't budge either. So I order him out, bark at him, and he obeys. And I tell him, you march with me to the bus, and these two kind comrades will escort you to the Ostbahnhof. And from the Ostbahnhof you go home to the Hohenschönhausen and wait until your father shows up. That's an order, comrade. Then he asked me where his mother's going and why he's not going with her. So I say, your mother's got important secret work to do in Dresden, and it's your duty as a good soldier for communism to go back to your father and continue the struggle. And he goes. 5 second silence. Well, what the fuck else was he supposed to do? He's a party kid with a party father and he's 6 years old, for fuck's sake. J.O. And Tulip, meanwhile? A.L. Sitting in the fucking trabby, staring out the windscreen in a trance. I get in, drive a kilometer, then stop again and haul her out. There's a helicopter buzzing overhead. Fuck knows what he thinks he's doing. Fuck knows where he got a helicopter from. Borrowed it from the Russians? Listen, I tell her, just fucking listen, because we need each other. Sending your kid back to Berlin is not the end of the problem, it's the beginning of a new one. 2 hours from now, the entire Stasi will know that Doris Quinn's Nee Gamp was last seen in the vicinity of Cottbus, heading east with her male friend. They'll have a description of the car of the lot. So goodbye to any ideas we had about driving this lot of shit into Chekhov on false papers, because from now on every Stasi and KGB unit and every frontier post from Kaliningrad to Odessa is going to be on the lookout for a piebald plastic trabby with a pair of fascist spies in it. And she takes it on the chin, I'll give her that. No more dramatics, just ask me straight out what the fallback is, and I say, one out-of-date smuggler's map that I brought along as an afterthought, which with luck and a prayer might just possibly get us over the border on foot. So she thinks hard about this, and then she asks me, it's like the clincher for her, if I come with you, will I see my son again? Which suggests to me that she is seriously considering turning herself in for the boy's sake. So I grab her by the shoulders and swear blind into her face that I'll get her boy traded in an agent swap if it's the last thing I do on her. And I know as well as you do there's as much chance of that ever happening as... 3 second pause. Fuck it. Was it purely for reasons of economy that in my later transcript, which I am now reading, I departed from Alex's spoken words at this point, preferring to paraphrase them for greater, shall we say, objectivity? From the moment of leaving Gustav in the care of the two sorbs, Alec clung to Minor Rose wherever the snow permitted. His problem, he explained, was knowing too bloody much about the perils of the terrain they were crossing. The whole area was awash with military intelligence and KGB listening stations, and he knew them all by heart. He spoke of traversing empty, dead-straight minor roads with 6 inches of virgin snow on them, only the tree lines to guide him. Of his relief at entering forest until Tulip gave a yell of horror. She had spotted the former Nazi hunting lodge where the GDR elite brought visiting dignitaries to shoot deer and wild boar and get drunk. They made a hasty detour, lost their bearings, and saw a light burning in a remote farmhouse. Limas thumped on the door. It was opened by a terrified peasant woman clutching a knife. Having obtained directions from her, he persuaded her to sell him bread, sausage, and a bottle of Slivovitz, and on his way back to the Trabant, tripped over a sagging telephone cable. He assumed for sounding a fire alarm. He cut it anyway. The day was darkening, the snow thickening. The piebald Trabant was on her last legs. Clutch shot, heater shot, gearbox shot. Smoke belching out of the bonnet. He reckoned that they were about 10 kilometers from Bad Schandau and 15 from the crossing point on the smuggler's map. Having confirmed their position as best he could by compass, he selected an eastbound timber track and drove until they hit a snowdrift. Huddled together in the trabby in freezing cold, they ate bread and wurst, drank the Slivovitz, froze and watched the deer go by, while Tulip, half asleep with her head on Alec's shoulders, languidly described her hopes and dreams for her new life with Gustav in England. She would not wish Gustav to go to Eton. She had heard that English boarding schools were run by pederasts like his father. She would prefer a proletarian state school with girls. Much sport, not too strict. Gustav would start learning English from the day he arrived, she would see to that. For his birthday, she would buy him an English bicycle. She had heard Scotland was beautiful. They would bicycle together in Scotland. She was still talking in this vein, dozing, when Alec became aware of 4 silent male figures with Kalashnikovs standing like sentinels around the car. Ordering Tulip to remain where she was, he opened the door and slowly got out while they watched him. None was above 17, he reckoned, and they seemed as scared as he was. Seizing the initiative, he demanded to know what they thought they were doing, sneaking up on a courting couple. At first, nobody answered. Then the boldest explained that they were poachers looking for meat, to which Alec replied that, if they kept their mouths shut, he would do the same. They sealed the bond by shaking hands all round, after which the 4 men silently vanished. The day dawns clear, no snow. Soon a pale sun is shining. Together they tip the piebald Trabant down a slope and chuck snow and branches over it. It's a walk from here on. Tulip has only light leather boots, knee length, no tread. Alec's workman's boots a little better. They set out grabbing each other's hands as they slide and slip. They are in Saxon Switzerland, a wonderland of steep, undulating snowfields and forests. On the hillsides, old houses fall into ruin or turned into summer orphanages. If the map is to be believed, they are walking parallel to the border. Hand in hand, they battle their way up a rise and skirt a frozen pond. They are in a mountain village of small wooden houses. A.L. If the map was right, we were either dead or in Chekhov. Clink of glass, sounds of pouring liquid. But the story has barely begun. See accompanying circus telegrams. See also the reason why, having listened to Alec's tape, I am still sitting tensely on the top floor of Covert's HQ in Marylebone in the small hours, waiting any minutes to be summoned to head office. Sally Ormond, deputy head of station Prague, wife to head of station Jerry, is the type of upper-class female go-getter the circus blindly adores. Cheltenham Ladies' College. Father in SOE in the war. Couple of aunts at Bletchley. Also claims a mysterious kinship by marriage with George, which, to my mind, he bears a little too nobly. Report by Sally Ormond, DH, Station Prague, to H. Covert, Smiley. Personal and private. Priority, crash. Station orders from Covert were to receive, support and securely accommodate one disguised officer, Alec Limas, and one escaping woman agent travelling on East German papers in an East German registered Trabant. Registration supplied, expected to arrive in the early hours of darkness. The station was not, however, informed that the operation was being carried out contrary to joint steering's instructions. We could only assume that once it was known that Limas had taken matters into his own hands, HO decided to afford operational support. Berlin station, De Jong, had advised us that on entering Czech territory, Limas would signal safe arrival by means of a no-name call to embassy visa section inquiring whether UK visas were valid in Northern Ireland. Prague station would respond by activating a recorded announcement advising him to call again in office hours. This would be an acknowledgement of message received. Limas and Tulip would then proceed by whatever means possible to a point on the road between Prague City and Prague Airport and park in a siding, map reference supplied. Under the plan put forward by this station and approved by H. Covert, the couple would abandon the car and a symbolized driver from Prague's Godiva network would commandeer the embassy shuttle, CD plates and blackened side windows, which regularly ferries embassy personnel to and from Prague Airport. He would then collect Limas and Tulip from the agreed RV. The rear of the van would contain formal Western clothing supplied by this station. Limas and Tulip would dress themselves as official dinner guests of HM Ambassador and on that pretext bluff their way into the embassy, which is under the permanent watch of Czech security. At 10:40 hours, an emergency conference was held in the embassy safe room, at which Her Excellency the Ambassador, H.E., graciously consented to this plan. However, by 1600 hours UK time, having further consulted the Foreign Office, she revised her decision without apology on the grounds that since the fugitive woman had been in the meantime widely featured on GDR media as a state criminal, the potential for diplomatic repercussions outweighed earlier considerations. In light of HE's stated position, no embassy vehicle and no embassy staff could be deployed in the escape plan. I therefore disconnected Visa Section's automatic reply system in the hope that this would indicate to Limas that no support was available. I've replaced my earphones. I'm back with Alec, not in the imperial comfort of our British Embassy in Prague, but stuck at the freezing roadside with Tulip, and no support, no pickup car, and, as Alec would say, no fuck all. I'm remembering what he's preached ever since I've known him. When you're planning an op, think of every way the service can fuck you up, then wait for the one way you never thought of, but they have. And I reckon that's exactly what he's thinking now. A.L. verbatim resumed. When no shuttle showed up and no joy out of Visa Section, I just thought, fuck it, that's London for you. So the only thing is make it up as you go along. We're a distressed East German couple at the roadside. My wife's sick as a dog, so help us, somebody. I told Doris to sit on the pavement and look pathetic, which suits her just fine. And in due course, a lorry full of bricks pulls up and a driver leans out. By the luck of the gods, he's a German from Leipzig and he wants to know whether I'm pimping the pretty lady sitting on the pavement. So I say, no, sorry, mate, she's my wife and she's ill. And he says, okay, get in. And he drives us as far as the hospital in the city centre. I've got a rainy day UK passport stitched into the lining of my shoulder bag, name of Miller. I unpick it and bung it in my pocket. Then I say to her, you're really seriously ill, Doris. You're pregnant and you're getting more ill by the minute, so do me a favor, bag out your tummy and look as fucking awful as you feel. So they open the doors and in we come. Sorry about that. J.O. Not quite the whole story, though, is it? Liquid pouring. A.L. Jesus, all right then. We come up your cobble lane out there. We approach your noble gates with Her Majesty's royal crest on them in tasteful gold paint. There's three Czech goons in grey suits hanging around outside, doing nothing very deliberately. Maybe you haven't noticed them. Doris is putting on an act Sarah Bernhardt would have given her eyes for. I wave my UK passport at them. Let us in quick. The buggers want to see her passport too. Listen, I tell them in my best English, just press that fucking button you've got on the wall there and tell them inside that my wife's having a miscarriage, so get a fucking doctor round. And if she has it here in the street, it'll be on your fucking heads. And haven't you got mothers of your own? Probably you haven't, or worse to that effect, okay? And abracadabra, the gates are parted. and we're standing in the embassy courtyard. And Tulip is clutching her gut and thanking her patron saint for delivering us from evil, and you and your dear lady wife are apologizing profusely for yet another king-size head office fuck-up. So thank you both for the gracious apology accepted, and if you don't mind, I'll go and get some fucking sleep. Sally Ormond takes back the story. Extract from Sally Ormond, DH Station Prague, personal informal handwritten DO letter to H. Covert, Smiley, by Circus Bag, Priority, Crash. Well, of course, once we'd got poor Tulip and Alec inside the embassy compound, that's when the real fun started. I honestly think Ambass and the FO would have been far happier if she had simply been handed back to the GDR authorities and no more said. For starters, Ambass wouldn't have had Tulip inside her house at all, even if legally it didn't make a jot of difference. She actually insisted that two janitors be moved into the main building just so that poor Tulip could be shoved in the servants' area, which from a security point of view works rather better than the main house. But that wasn't at all her reason, as she made totally clear the moment we were all four of us squashed into the embassy safe room. Her Excellency, attended by Arthur Lansdowne, her very private secretary, plus my dear husband and self. And Alec absolutely not bien vu by HE, of which more later, and anyway, mopping Tulip's brow in the servants' area. And P.S., George, a word in your ear, if we may. The embassy safe room is extremely stuffy and a potential health risk at all times, as repeatedly reported in vain by self to HO admin. The Mickey Mouse aircon system is totally kaput. It breathes in when it should breathe out, but according to Barker, admin's pest-in-chief, no spare parts have been available for the last 2 years, and since nobody in the FO has seen fit to send us a new system, anyone using the place just stews and suffocates. Last week, poor Jerry nearly did suffocate, but of course he's too noble to say. I suggested about a million times that the safe room be made a circus responsibility, but that apparently would be an infringement of FO territorial rights. If you can possibly agitate with admin, unattributably, not Barker, I suggest, hugely grateful. Jerry joins me in sending much love and huge fealty as ever, especially to Anne. S. Text of immediate top-secret telegram from British Ambassador, Prague, personal to Sir Alwyn Withers, H. East European Department, the Foreign Office, copy to Circus, Joint Steering. Minutes of crisis meeting in Embassy Safe Room, held at 2100 hours. Present, H.E. Ambassador, Margaret Renford, Arthur Lansdowne, Private Secretary to H.E., Jerry Ormond, H. Station, Sally Ormond, D.H. Station. Purpose of meeting, management and disposal of temporary embassy resident. Priority, crash. Dear Alwyn, after our secure telephone call of this morning, the following procedure has been agreed between the two of us regarding the onward journey of our uninvited guest, OUG. 1. OUG will travel to her next destination on what our friends assure us will be a valid non-British passport. This will forestall later accusations by Czech authorities that this embassy is dishing out UK passports to any Tom, Dick and Harry of whatever nationality attempting to evade GDR, Czech justice. 2. OUG will not be assisted, accompanied or transported in any manner by diplomatic or non-diplomatic members of embassy staff in the course of her departure. No vehicle with British diplomatic number plates will be used for her exfiltration. No false British papers will be issued to her. 3. If OUG at any point claims she has the protection of the British Embassy, it is understood that this will be immediately and robustly denied, locally and in London. 4. OUG's departure from Embassy Compound will occur within 3 working days, or other steps for her removal will be considered, including surrender of OUG to Czech authorities. My telephone is buzzing and the red light is winking. It's Toby Bloody Esterhaz, gopher to Percy Allerline and Bill Hayden, yelling at me in his thick Hungarian accent to get my candy ass over to head office double quick. Advising him to watch his language, I jump on my motorbike, which is being held ready for me outside the front door. Minutes of emergency conference held in joint steering safe room at Cambridge Circus. Presiding, Bill Hayden, HJS. Present, Colonel Etienne Jabroche, military attaché, French Embassy, London, Chief of French Intelligence Liaison, Jules Purdy, JS French Desk, Jim Prideaux, JS Balkans Desk, George Smiley, H. Covert, Peter Gwillem, Jack. Note taker assigned to meeting, T. Esterhaz. Recorded, part transcribed verbatim. Flash copy to H. Station Prague. It's 5 in the morning. The summons has come. I've arrived from Marylebone by motorbike. George has come straight from Treasury. He is unshaven and looks more than usually worried. You're entirely free to say no at any point, Peter, he has twice assured me. He has already described the operation as needlessly elaborate, but his greater concern, try as he might to conceal it, is that the operational plan is the collective achievement of joint steering. We are 6 at the long plywood table in the circus safe room. Jabroche. Bill, my dear friend, my masters in Paris need to be assured that your Monsieur Jacques can hold his own on matters of small farming in France. Hayden. Tell him, Jacques. Quillem. I'm not worried about that, Colonel. Jabroche. Not even in the company of experts? Quillem. I grew up on a French smallholding in Brittany. Hayden. Is Brittany French? You amaze me, Jacques. Laughter. Jabroche. Bill, with your permission. Switching to French, Colonel Jabroche engages Gwillem in an animated discussion on the French farming industry, with particular reference to northwest France. Jabroche. I'm satisfied, Bill. He passes. He even speaks like a Breton, poor man. More laughter. Hayden. But will it play, Etienne? Can you really get him in? Jabroche. In, yes. Out will be up to Monsieur Jacques and his good lady. You are in the nick of time. The list of French delegates closes imminently. We are already holding it open. I suggest we keep the presence of Monsieur Jacques at the conference as brief as possible. We enroll him. He goes on the collective visa. He is delayed by illness, but he is determined to make the closing session. As one of 300 international delegates, he will not be unduly conspicuous. Do you speak Finnish, Monsieur Jacques? Gwillem. Not a lot, Colonel. Jabroche. I thought all Bretons did. Laughter. And the lady in the case speaks no French. Quillem. To our knowledge, German and school Russian, but no French. Jabroche. But she has panache, you say. She is personable. She has elan. She can dress. Smiley. Jack, you've seen her. I had seen her dressed, and I had seen her undressed. I select the first. Quillem. We've only brushed past, but she's impressive. Good tradecraft, quick thinking, creative, spirited. Hayden. Jesus, creativity. Who the hell needs creativity? Woman needs to do what she's bloody told and shut up, doesn't she? Is it a goer or not, Jack? Gwillem. I'm up for it if George is. Hayden. Is he? Smiley. Given that Joint and the Colonel are providing the necessary field support, we at Covert are prepared to accept the risk. Hayden. Well, that sounds a bit bloody mealy-mouthed, I must say. It's a goer, then. Etienne, I'm assuming you'll supply Monsieur Jacques with his French passport and travel papers, or do you want us to do that? Jabroche. Ours are better. Laughter. Kindly also remember, Bill, that if things come unstuck, my government will be very shocked to discover that your perfidious English Secret Service is encouraging its agents to masquerade as French citizens. Hayden. And we shall deny the accusation vigorously and apologize. To Prideaux. Jim boy, a comment? You've been mysteriously silent. Checo's your patch. Are you happy with us trampling all over it? Prideaux. Not objecting, if that's what you mean. Hayden. Anything you want to add or subtract? Prideaux. Not offhand. Hayden. Okay, gents, that's all. It's a goer. So let's get down to it. Jack, our thoughts go with you. Etienne. Maybe a private word. But George doesn't give up his misgivings easily. Witness the next serial. The clock is ticking. I am to leave for Prague in 6 hours. PG to H. Covert. George. We spoke. You asked me to put down my experience of the field dispatch office at Heathrow Terminal 3, presently under Joint Steering's command. In appearance, the FDO is just another seedy airport office at the end of an unswept corridor. A glazed door is marked Freight Interlink. Access is by entryphone. Once inside, the atmosphere is depressing. A couple of weary couriers playing cards, a woman barking Spanish into a telephone, one dresser only working a double shift because her colleague is off sick, cigarette smoke, full ashtrays, and only one cubicle because they're waiting for new curtains for the other one. The big surprise was the reception party that awaited my appearance. Alaline, Bland, Esterhaas. If Bill H. had been there, I'd have had a full hand. Ostensibly, they'd come to see me off and wish me well. Alaline to the fore as ever, produced my French passport and conference ID, courtesy of Jabroche, with great flourish. Esterhaas did the same with my travelling case and props. Clothing bought in Rennes, agricultural handbooks and a history of how France built the Suez Canal for light reading, etc. Roy Bland played Big Brother and slyly asked me if there was anyone I'd like informed if I was away a few years longer than expected. But the real purpose of their attentions could not have been clearer. They wanted to know more about Tulip, where she was coming from, how long she'd been working for us, who had the handling of her. And then the strangest moment when, having fended off their questions, I was standing in the cubicle being dressed and Toby E. shoved his head round the curtain saying he had the following personal message for me from Bill. Any time you get tired of your Uncle George, think head of station Paris. My reply was non-committal. Peter. Now meet George in his role as the ultimate operational pedant, bent on closing every loophole in joint steering's notoriously slipshod planning. Signal from H. Covert Smiley to H. Station Prague, Ormond. Top secret, Mayflower. Priority, crash. A. Finnish passport for subsource Tulip will arrive tomorrow by bag in name of Venia Lesif, born Helsinki, nutrition expert, married name of spouse, Adrian Lesif. Passport will contain stamped Czech entry visa, date of entry to coincide with communist French-sponsored conference for Fields of Peace. B. Peter Gwillem will arrive Prague Airport on Air France Flight 412 tomorrow morning at 10:40 hours local time, travelling on French National's passport in name of Adrian Lesif, visiting lecturer in agrarian economics at Rennes University. Czech entry visa also valid to coincide with conference. Lesif's appearance at conference notionally delayed by illness. Both Lesifs currently appear on conference list of participants, one participant delayed, one spouse. C. Also by tomorrow's bag, two Air France tickets, Prague, Paris, Le Bourget, for Adrian and Venia Lesif, departing 0600 hours, 28th of January. Air France records will confirm that the couple flew to Prague on separate dates, see entry stamps, but will be returning to Paris with fellow academics in the group. D. Accommodation for Professor and Madame Lesif has been booked at the Hotel Balkan, where the French delegation will be housed overnight prior to early morning departure for Paris Le Bourget. And Sally Ormond, in reply, missing no opportunity to sing her own praises. Extract from second personal letter, Sally Ormond to George Smiley, marked strictly personal and private to you, not for the record. On receipt of your very lucid signal, herewith gratefully acknowledged, Jerry and I decided I should go and prepare Tulip for her departure from the embassy and her coming ordeal. I duly crossed the courtyard to the annex suite where we'd housed Tulip, double curtains on street side, camp bed for self in passage outside bedroom door, extra chancery guard posted in downstairs hall in case of unwelcome visitors. I found her sitting on the bed with Alec with his arm round her shoulder, but she seemed not to know he was there, just every now and then sobbing in semi-silent hiccups. Be that as it may, I took firm charge of the situation and, as planned, sent Alec off for fresh air and a boys' walk beside the river with Jerry. My German language being pretty much stuck at level 2, I couldn't get a lot out of her at first, though I doubt it would have made much difference because she was hardly talking, let alone listening. She whispered Gustav at me several times, and I gathered after a bit of sign language that Gustav was not her man, but her Sohn. But I did manage to get through to her that she would be leaving the embassy tomorrow, flying to England, but not directly, and that she would be attached to a mixed French tour group of academics and agriculturalists. Her first reaction, very naturally, was how could she possibly if she didn't speak a word of French? And when I said that wasn't going to matter because she would be Finnish, and nobody speaks Finnish, do they? Her next reaction was, in these clothes? Which was my cue to unpack all the brilliant goodies Paris Station had got together for us at no notice at all. Gorgeous barley-coloured twin set from Printemps, lovely shoes just her size, dishy nightdress and underclothes, makeup literally to die for. Paris Station must have spent a fortune. Just everything she must have been dreaming of for the last 20 years, even if she didn't know it, and nice labels from Tour to complete the illusion. And a very pretty engagement ring, I wouldn't have minded myself, and a decent gold wedding ring rather than the ersatz bit of tin she was wearing, all to be returned on landing, of course, but I didn't think that needed saying quite yet. And by then she was into it. The pro in her had woken up. She looked very carefully at her nice new passport, not actually new, and declared it pretty good. And when I told her that a gallant Frenchman would accompany her and pretend to be her husband for the journey, she said that sounded a sensible arrangement, and what did he look like? So as ordered, I showed her a photograph of Peter G, and she peered at it rather expressionlessly, I have to say, given that as proxy husbands go, you could do a lot worse than PG. Finally, she asked, is he French or English? And I said, both, and you're Finnish and French. And my dear, she hooted with laughter. And quite soon after that, Alec and Jerry came back from their walk, and with the ice broken, we got down to the serious briefing. She listened carefully and calmly. By the end of our session, I had the feeling she had really warmed to the whole idea, and in a rather awful way thought it fun. A bit of a danger addict, I thought, and in that way only, very like Alec. Take care. And my love as ever to our gorgeous Anne, S. Make no hasty or inadvertent body movement. Keep your hands and shoulders exactly where they are now and breathe. Pepsi is back on her throne, but she can't take her eyes off you. And it's not love. Report by Peter Gwillem on temporary attachment to covert ops. Ray exfiltration of subsource Tulip from Prague to Paris Le Bourget for onward transit by RAF fighter plane to London, Northolt Airport, 27th of January 1960. I arrived at Prague Airport at 11:25 hours local time, flight delayed, in the person of visiting lecturer in agrarian economics at the University of Rennes. I understood that, thanks to French liaison, my late arrival due to illness had been formally noted at the conference and my name included on the list of attendees for the benefit of the Czech authorities. In further verification of my bona fides, I was met by the cultural attaché from the French embassy, who used his diplomatic credentials to hasten airport processing, which passed off relatively easily with the attaché acting as my interpreter. He then drove me in his official car to the French embassy, where I signed the visitor's book before being delivered, also by French embassy car, to the conference, where a seat had been reserved for me in the back row. The conference hall was a gilded, operatic affair, originally built for the Central Council of Railwaymen and accommodating up to 400 delegates. Security was cursory. Halfway up the grand staircase, two overworked women who spoke only Czech sat at a desk ticking off the names of delegates from half a dozen countries. The conference itself took the form of a seminar conducted by a panel of experts seated on the stage with choreographed contributions from the floor. No input from myself was required. I was impressed by the deftness of French liaison, who at short notice had authenticated my presence in the eyes of Czech security and of the delegates, two of whom were clearly conscious to my role and found time to seek me out and shake my hand. At 1700 hours, the conference was declared closed, and the French delegates were bussed to the Hotel Balkan, a small, old-fashioned establishment that had been set aside for our exclusive use. On checking in, I was handed a key to bedroom number 8, designated as a family room since I was notionally one half of a married couple. The Balkan has a dining room for residents, and leading from it, a bar with a central table where I placed myself in anticipation of my notional wife's arrival. My broad understanding was that she would be exfiltrated from the British Embassy by tame ambulance, transported to a safe house in the suburbs, and thence to the Hotel Balkan by unexplained means. I was therefore impressed to see her arrive in a French diplomatic car on the arm of the same cultural attaché who had welcomed me to Prague Airport. I wish again to acknowledge here the acumen and tradecraft of French liaison. Under the name of Venia Lessif, Tulip had been listed as a delegate spouse attending the conference in absentia. Her good looks and fashionable appearance caused a mild stir among other French delegates in the hotel, and again I was supported by the two male members who, having greeted me with familiarity at the conference, saluted and embraced Tulip as a friend. Tulip, in return, received their compliments with style, affecting broken German only, which became our lingua franca as a married couple, since my own German is limited. After dinner, taken in the company of the two French delegates who played their part to perfection, we did not linger in the bar with the rest of the delegates, but repaired early to our bedroom, where by tacit agreement our conversation was confined to banalities consistent with our cover, the presence of microphones and even cameras in a hotel for foreigners being virtually certain. Fortunately, our room was spacious, with several single beds and two hand basins. For much of the night, we were obliged to listen to the rowdy chatter of the delegates below and, into the small hours, singing. It is my impression that neither Tulip or I slept. At 0400 hours, we reassembled and were taken by bus to Prague Airport, where, miraculously as it now appears to me, we were cleared en bloc to the transit lounge and thence by Air France to Le Bourget. I wish once more to offer my unstinted thanks for the support of French liaison. How the next entry found its way into my report momentarily confounds me until I conclude that I must have added it as some kind of distraction. Personal and confidential handwritten DO letter to George Smiley from Jerry Ormond, H Station Prague, not for file. Dear George, well, the bird has certainly flown to massive sighs of relief here, as you can imagine, and is by now presumably safely, if not happily installed, at Chateau Tulip, somewhere in England. Her flight in both senses seems to have gone reasonably smoothly, despite the fact that Jonah, at the last minute, needed $500 on top of salary before consenting to drive Tulip to the RV in his ambulance, the little sod. But Tulip isn't who I'm writing to about, and least of all, Jonah. It's Alec. As you've often said in the past, as professionals bound in secrecy, we have a duty of care, and it's for one another. And that means being mutually watchful, and if one of us appears to be cracking under the strain and is not aware of it, then it's our duty to protect him from himself and by the same token protect the service too. Alec is the absolute best fieldman you and I know. He's savvy as hell, dedicated, streetwise, has all the skills, and he has just pulled off one of the neatest and most dicey operations it's been my pleasure to witness, albeit over the heads of joint steering, our revered ambassador and the mandarins of Whitehall. So when he knocks home 3/4 of a bottle of scotch at a sitting and then picks a fight with a chancery guard he happens to dislike, we make all the allowances and then some. But we walked, Alec and I, along the river for an hour, then up to the castle, then back to the embassy. So a 2-hour walk while he was still by his own standards dead sober. And his one theme in all that time was, the circus is penetrated. Not just by some male clerk with a mortgage, but at the top of the tree in joint, where it really counts. And it's more than just a bee in his bonnet, it's a whole hive. It's disproportionate, it's not fact-based, and frankly, it's paranoid. Coupled with his visceral hatred of all things American, it makes for difficult conversation, to say the least, and becomes even more alarming. And under the laws of our profession, as defined by no less a person than yourself, and with all due affection and respect, I am duly reporting my concerns to you. As ever, Jerry. P.S. and to Anne, as ever, homage and much love, J. And from Laura, a rosette, ordering me to stop.
Nice read.
Tolerable, thank you, Bunny.
Well, Christ, you wrote it, didn't you? Gave you a bit of a buzz, surely, after all that time.
He has brought a male friend along with him this late afternoon, a blonde, smiling, well-polished youth, not a mark of life on him.
Peter, this is Leonard,
says Bunny ceremoniously, as if I ought to know who Leonard is.
Leonard will be counsel for the service if our little matter ever comes to court, which of course we devoutly hope it won't.
He will also be appearing for us at the preliminary meeting of the all-party group inquiry next week, at which, as you know, we have already been tapped to appear. Richtel grin. Leonard, Peter. We shake hands. Leonard's soft as a child's. If Leonard is representing the service, what's he doing here with me? I demand. A getting to know each other's faces, says Bunny soothingly. Leonard's a black letter lawyer. And seeing my eyebrows go up, which merely means that he's versed in every legal wrinkle in the book and some that aren't even in the book, puts run-of-the-mill lawyers like me in the shade. Oh, come.